You're listening to Booth Talk from the After Movie Diner. And on this incredibly special episode, it's all about filmmaker and writer Larry Cohen. If you've watched any movies in the last 40 years, and I have to assume that you have, you've probably seen something that this guy has had a hand in. He's an incredible writer and a really fascinating filmmaker with an interesting guerrilla on-the-fly style. From the cool 70s classics of films like Bone, Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem, It's Alive and God Told Me to the genre brilliance of his 80s work in stuff like Q, The Stuff, A Return to Salem's Lot, Maniac Cop, and The Ambulance, not to mention his writing gigs on films like Bestseller and Phone Booth, Larry Cohen has been across the last four decades of filmmaking with some of the most innovative, interesting, high-concept, and well-written films that have been made. Last year, in 2017, a documentary called King Cohen, The Wild World of Filmmaker Larry Cohen, started to do the rounds on the festival circuit, featuring interviews with people such as J.J. Abrams, Rick Baker, Joe Dante, Martin Scorsese, Robert Forster, Mick Garris, Fred the Hammer Williamson, Michael Moriarty, and way, way more. It is an absolutely fascinating look at not just Larry Cohen and his career, but also the businesses that he's inhabited, whether it's stand-up comedy, whether it's writing for TV, writing for film, and finally directing his own stuff. It's an absolutely fascinating ride through, as I said, the last 40 years of movie making. Not only do we talk to Larry Cohen on this episode, but we also talk to the director of the documentary, Steve Mitchell. So if you're not a fan of Larry Cohen's or have never heard of him right now, by the end of this episode, you better go watch everything he's ever done, because I tell you, it's absolutely fascinating the way the guy writes and the movies that he puts out there. And the documentary is a must-see whenever it gets a full release. And if it comes to a festival near you, I can definitely suggest checking it out. So anyway, enough of my blathering. Let's head over and speak to the one, the only, the individual and awesome, Larry Cohen. Is this Larry Cohen?
I think so.
Excellent. This is John Cross from the After Movie Diner.
Oh, well, that's nice. So go ahead and ask me any questions you like.
All right. Thank you so much, Larry. And it's a real pleasure to have you on the show. So King Cohen, a documentary about your life and career, is out now doing the tour of festivals and screenings. What was your first reaction when Steve Mitchell approached you to do a documentary?
Well, I didn't anticipate it, and I didn't do anything to encourage it. It just happened. He just came to me and said he wanted to do a documentary, and he would see people that worked on my films. And I said, fine, as long as I don't have to have anything to do with it. You know, usually I've made all these films over the years, and I was the writer, producer, director, and I had full control of the movie. And my policy is, if I don't have complete control, I don't want anything to do with it. So this was Steve Mitchell's project, and I just said, I'll keep out of it. You make any picture up that you want to. You smear my name if you want to, and, you know, destroy my career if you wish. Go ahead. I'm not going to try and stop you. And he went out and did just that.
Well, I mean, you've been a strong supporter of it, though. You've been showing up at screenings everywhere it's been shown.
Well, yeah, but there's always a free meal or something like that.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Well, that's good then. As long as they're paying the flight and the hotels, right? That's the best.
That's the whole idea. Yeah, and you know, it's those hotel rooms that, yeah, boy, they're the greatest. And so and you know, and flying on airplanes is really exciting too. So, you know, I never knew I was going to get so much excitement out of this project. No.
Well, it's been showing all over the world, and it's getting absolutely rave reviews. And I saw it in New York when you guys were here with the New York Festival in Chelsea. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. As a writer, had you ever considered an autobiography or a book about filmmaking or anything like that? Or was this just the first time you'd ever kind of done a career retrospective?
No, I wrote a biography of myself, which I have, and it's complete. It's up, pretty much up to date. I've just been waiting to see how it all turns out, you know. So It's finished for the most part, and all I have to do is submit it to publishers. And I've waited around, and maybe the release of this documentary will help getting the biography published.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And what were some of the sort of fondest memories or moments that maybe you'd not thought of in a while that making the documentary unearthed or brought back for you?
Fondest memories? I don't know. There was a lot of nice people that showed up in the documentary that said nice things about me, so I didn't think they liked me, but apparently they were crazy about me. I was so mean to them all, too, and they just would have thought I was the greatest guy in the world the way they were talking. I think they maybe got me mixed up with one of the Coen brothers.
Well, I wonder if that's not because film, obviously, over time, especially some of the kind of cult classics and the movies that you've done that have gained a huge audience over time and film fandom and things, whether that with that distance from the filmmaking process, they forget your meanness and they remember the great work that they constantly get fans hassling them about.
Yeah, I was hoping they'd remember my meanness, though. It makes for a more interesting movie, you know. People like villains and stuff like that.
Oh, true.
I came out as a hero in this particular picture, and, you know, I don't know. I would have been more interesting if I was just a terrible person. you know, when they make movies about Hollywood, usually everybody in it are terrible people. They're all rats, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
If you look at the movies about Hollywood, the bad and the beautiful, stuff like that, you know, nobody's ever a nice guy. They're always ruthless and cruel and selfish and, you know, take advantage of women, you know, when you can't do that anymore. But at any rate, you know, they're just not nice people. You know, it gives you the feeling if you want to be in show business, you have to be a son of a bitch. But, you know, in this picture, I come out just, I'm just a lovely person.
Yeah, well, I think the only thing is at one point Fred Williamson contradicts your story about doing a stunt for him. I think that's the only time where he says you're lying. I think that's the only
time.
Well,
he's lying. He's lying. I mean, there's no question that he's lying. I mean, if you look at it later on, there's a scene in the documentary where he gets buried under a pile of coal by a scooping machine. And I did that stunt for him before he did it. And the proof of it is there's a photograph in the documentary right afterwards of me standing with Fred, and I'm as black as he is.
Yeah.
And that's because I just climbed out from being under all this coal. And there's no question that I did it. So, obviously, why would I do it after him? I would only do it before him. So
okay.
He just didn't want to admit he was scared, and I had to do all these stunts for him. He didn't want to lose face. So I let it alone. But there's many people are telling lies in this particular film, particularly when they say I was nice to them, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can imagine. So talking about Fred, looking back, you actually made some key and quintessential movies in the boom of that African-American filmmaking in the early 70s, and then again in the 90s with Original Gangsters. What are your thoughts of that era of filmmaking and its importance, if it had any?
Well, to me, they were just gangster movies. I mean, it never dawned on me about them being black exploitation or black this or black that. I just thought it's nice to get a couple of black actors to give them a job once in a while and have them play something other than playing servants, which is what they all played up until that time. So to see black actors winning a fight and getting the girl and coming out on top, that was nice. I didn't see anything about it that would qualify as black exploitation. And as long as the actors are good actors, I never cared what color they were.
Yeah, and I think they've just started, they kind of use that term where it's like with the Ozploitation or blaxploitation, they sort of add that exploitation bit at the end of it. I don't really understand it because, like you say, no one's really being exploited. But, you know, actually, if anything, they're getting work where before they hadn't been. But it's just it becomes sort of a catch-all phrase for the era, I guess.
Somebody politically made up a term and then it got popularized. But as far as I was concerned, all the actors were paid the same as white actors would have been paid. and there was no differentiation with them at all, and I was happy to give them jobs.
Yeah, and Fred's fantastic in the films that you did with him. We had the pleasure of talking to Fred a couple of years back, and when he was trying to do Original Gangsters 2, when he was trying to put that together, was there any talk of you working on that with him or not?
I told him I would do it. I think he wanted to direct it himself, to be perfectly honest with you, but then it wouldn't have been very good, because most of the pictures he directed were not very good. The pictures he did that were good were ones like that I made. And no aspersions, because he says he learned everything about directing from me, but he didn't learn the right things. He certainly shoots the pictures in a brief amount of time, but he doesn't get the performances. But I admire him for his tenacity and for able to go out and get the financing. And on Original Gangsters, he deserves all the credit, because he actually had developed the script, which I had nothing to do with originally, and he cast all the actors. So he presented me with a full cast. Even the smallest parts were cast by him. And the location, which was Gary, Indiana, which I wasn't too crazy about, because it was the gang capital of the world. But we went down there and shot it. And he was the producer of the picture, so he deserves all the credit for the film. I just came in and directed the actors, and he had a wonderful cast that he had assembled. So I appreciated it, and I thought I got a good performance out of the people, and that I made a better picture than would have been if I hadn't been involved in it. So that was a nice experience, except that it was like 105 degrees every day down there in Gary, Indiana. Some of the actors had to be on oxygen. So wow. it was a tough shoot.
Yeah, but one of the things that comes out of the documentary, and also you kind of hinted at there, is this sort of guerrilla on the fly, no permit style of filmmaking, and it kind of comes back with all the different movies that you've made. Tell us sort of how that developed and your personal philosophy behind that.
Well, the philosophy behind it is, if you don't have enough money, you can't make movies in a traditional style where they drive downtown and clog the streets up with trailers and dressing rooms and wardrobe trucks and more or less make a nuisance of themselves. And they naturally have to have police protection and close down the block. And, the store owners don't like it because people can't get into their shops. It's a big hassle. So with me, I just go down to the street where I want to shoot, put up the camera, get the actors over there, and we do the scene and we get out of there. So we're not bothering anybody. And most of the time, they don't even see where the camera is. So it's a lot more economical, and it's better for everybody.
And it must have been a lot of fun as well. Was there a part of you that was sort of mischievously enjoying it, or was it always just purely due to the budget?
No, I was just having a good time because we got away with it.
Yeah.
I used to have one of the cast members dressed as a police officer, and he closed down the street. And when you're talking about closing down 57th Street and 5th Avenue, that's where Trump Tower is now.
Right.
And we closed down the whole street, and all the traffic was diverted. We had no right to do that. And police cars came by and waved to us, and we waved back to them. The guy dressed as a cop, and yeah. They all thought we belonged there, so nobody stopped us. And when we did the J. Edgar Hoover movie in Washington, I had to close down Michigan Avenue between the White House and the Capitol because I brought 40 cars on there from the 1940s yeah. and 30s, and we couldn't have regular cars, current vehicles, driving up and down that street and mix them in with the old cars. So we had to close the street down. And fortunately, they had these wooden horses that used for parades at Washington, D.C., and we just grabbed the wooden horses and took them out and blocked the streets. And once again, the police came by and waved to us, and we waved back. They couldn't imagine. They couldn't imagine anybody had have the audacity to close down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah.
And today, of course, you go to jail for this, probably as a terrorist.
Right.
So I guess I was a terrorist in after all. I guess so. I wreaked terror everywhere. They said I scared everybody when we fired machine guns off the top of the Chrysler Building.
Yeah.
So I guess the movie should have been called Larry Cohen Terrorist.
Terrorist Cohen, yeah. It didn't quite have the ring to it, and I'm not sure it would get distribution, but...
King Cohen is too mild. Terrorist Cohen, that would have been the appropriate title for the damn thing.
fair enough. Maybe a tagline when it gets its Blu-ray release. People
say to me, you know, what was the most dangerous thing you ever shot? And it wasn't the top of the Chrysler Building or the top of the Times Square where we had a guy shooting a rifle off above the signs on Times Square, or the big fight we had in the airport in Los Angeles with, without permission.
Yeah.
The scariest thing I ever did was making the movie about J. Edgar Hoover. Because everybody in town told me, you can't make that movie. The FBI will destroy you. Nobody's ever made a picture critical of the FBI. Nobody's ever made a picture without the FBI seal of approval and having an FBI man on the set every day that the FBI was depicted. And you can't do it. And I said, well, maybe I can't, but I'm going to try. And we made the picture. And other people came to me and said, you're crazy. The FBI was behind the blacklist, and the blacklist had Hollywood terrorized for years. And so many people lost their careers and never worked again and were ostracized. And all that information came from the FBI. That's who fed the information to the various blacklisters. And so he said, you're going to get yourself ruined by this picture. And the contrary. We went down to Washington, D.C. Next thing, we were shooting at Quantico, the FBI training academy, and at J. Edgar Hoover's house, and the place where he got his hair cut, and the place where he ate lunch every day with the waiter that waited on him every day. We got everything. And so it's truly amazing. But everybody else thought that this you'll never make another movie if you do this movie, because they'll run you out of town. Well, it was much harder to get distribution on the film because Warner Brothers and Universal and other studios, MGM particularly, got scared. They liked the picture, but MGM came to me and chairman of the board came out and he saw the picture. He says to me, kid, we're not in the movie business anymore. We're in the gambling business. And if you think we're going to take a chance at getting the FBI pissed off at us, you've got another thing coming. And it was pretty much the same with all the studios. They were all scared. But we finally got it released by American International.
Yeah. And one of the things that the documentary kicks up, again, as a fan of your work, was not just the stories behind some of the fan favorites or some of the favorites I had, but also some of the stories behind the films I don't think I had discovered yet, and maybe some of the audience haven't discovered yet. You speak about the J. Edgar Hoover movie. Are there any others that you hope will get a resurgence after this, or re-released or anything like that, and have new focus on? Were there any of your favorites that are kind of missed when people talk about your work?
Well, I've been doing these narrations on the Blu-ray releases of these movies, and so many of them are just coming out. And we did special effects, which is a picture about a movie director that goes crazy. And I did The Ambulance with James Earl Jones and Eric Roberts. And
fantastic.
And I just did that. And then last week I did Full Moon High with Alan Arkin and his son Adam Arkin. And so I've been doing these one after the other. And these pictures are all coming out in beautiful transfers, beautiful quality, and seeking an entire new audience. So as long as they keep coming out with new means of distribution, and the Blu-ray is the new one. And, of course, you get on cable.
Yeah.
You go on Netflix, and on Netflix, if you say my name, my picture comes up, and then up comes 12 or 14 of my movies that you can rent just by punching a button. You don't have to go to a video store. And you can see it right at your own leisure. And there's these movies, and they're readily available to everybody. So I love the fact that that you don't have to seek these films out. Years ago, when I was a kid, you had to wait for a revival house to show an old picture. You know, there were a few revival houses around town, and once in a while they'd show a picture you'd never seen or never heard of. But today, everything's available.
Yeah, and the ambulance, I got so excited. I saw that last year at the Quad when they did a retrospective of your work here in New York.
Right.
And absolutely loved the movie on the big screen, and then was really excited to see, I think the Blu-ray's out in February or March time, something like that, this year.
Yeah, I did a narration for it, so I know it's coming out soon.
Yeah,
and
can't
it's a
wait.
beautiful transfer. It looks wonderful, and the picture just plays great. I'm really proud of it. It's a real Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, what was it like making that film? Because was that one of the sort of last ones that you actually shot on location in New York?
I'm not sure if that was the last one in New York or not, but we did shoot all over the city. And I know I love New York because it's the world's greatest back lot. There's always something there of interest on every street. The old houses, the new ones, the tenements and the skyscrapers. I mean, there's no place you look where there isn't something interesting. And almost no place I look that I haven't shot.
Right.
When I go around the city, I pass one corner after another and one street after another where I shot something at one time or another. So, you know, I particularly like it when I see the St. Patrick's Day parade with all the 5,000 cops parading down Fifth Avenue and realize how I disrupted that.
Yeah, in God Told Me To and also Maniac Cop, right?
Well, they tried to do a little of it in Maniac Cop, but they didn't really carry forward. Nothing really happened in the parade in Maniac Cop, but a lot happened in the parade in the original God Told Me To, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was Andy Kaufman playing the crazy, berserk police officer.
And so do you think that there is any aspect of the way you used to make films in New York that could still be done today, or do you think it's almost entirely impossible now?
Well, because of security, and because there's cameras on every corner, and because everybody's so sensitive that, you know, anybody running around with a gun in their hand could very well be shot down, and I wouldn't want to be responsible for killing any actors, particularly if the picture hasn't been finished. So, you know...
you need them to live long enough to complete the film, definitely.
That's right. I mean, you wouldn't want to shoot a perfectly good actor. So, you know, I wouldn't try the same stuff anymore. It's just a little bit too crazy.
Yeah.
And I can understand it, and I know people would panic very easily today. Like if we fired the machine guns off the top of the Chrysler Building. Back then, there was a word going around that we were firing at the United Nations building, which was close by, and that was completely erroneous. But, you know, these things get around quickly, and pretty soon the people get exaggerated, and the next thing you know, the New York newspapers had front-page stories that we panicked crowds of people, and it never happened.
Yeah, and were you ever, was there ever a moment where you were worried, or that, you know, had you gone to prison, or had there been some issue or retaliation about all this running around you were doing, would that ever bother you, or were you prepared for whatever came?
I didn't think I was ever going to go to prison. You know, we were taken into custody once we sneaked into the New York Times building, which used to be in the 40s. And we started shooting in the New York Times building, and they came down and they took us into custody and took us up to their security office, and we talked our way out of it, and that was it. Meantime, my guys stole the film out of the camera and got out of there, so we had the footage anyway.
It's all important. The film is the all important thing. If you get that, that's all that matters.
Well, so, yeah, we got it. So the New York Times was never particularly friendly to me anyway. So at this particular time, I thought, well, worst thing is they'll take the film. But there was no film in the camera by that time.
Yeah. And one of the films you've been talking about with the firing from the Chrysler Building is probably my personal favorite, which is Cue the Winged Serpent, which stars Michael Moriarty. You've worked with Michael a lot. And he did some of his best work for you, in my opinion. What was that relationship like, and what did you see in him that made you two work together frequently?
Well, first of all, he was one of the most honored actors in the business. He'd won the Tony Award, Best Actor on Broadway. He won the Emmy Award several times, once with Katharine Hepburn in The Glass Menagerie, and another time in Holocaust, where he played the lead Nazi, and fabulous performances. Years later, he won another Emmy Award for playing James Dean's father in the James Franco version of James Dean's life story. He's the one who won the award. And he won the Golden Globe Awards, I think, twice. So he's won everything except the Oscar. And I did five pictures with this guy. And, you know, once you get an actor that really clicks, like Scorsese had Robert De Niro, and Fellini had Mastroianni. You know, when you get an actor that really seems to work with you, simpatico, you like to work with them over and over again.
And do you have one of his performances that for you particularly treasure over others?
Well, I thought the cue, of course, was his favorite, and it started us off. And he got to sing his song in it and everything else, you know. So
yeah.
He liked that one. He also liked the last one we did, which was called Pick Me Up. So, and he liked all of them to some degree. But, you know, of course, the seminal one was Q. That's the one that started us off. And we started off working in a certain way with a lot of improvisation. And I could stand behind the camera and yell things to him during a scene,
yeah.
And he would be able to integrate that into the dialogue without taking a pause, even without even flinching for a moment. He'd hear me and pick the words right out of the air and put them into the dialogue, and I cut myself out of the track later on. But that we made a lot of stuff up that way.
Yeah. And it's fantastic the way he's able to integrate that into the performance and then produce these performances that are both kind of, they're amazing, they're bizarre, but they're also, they just draw you in. Like, you can't look away once sort of Moriarty is speaking your dialogue. It's a winning combination. Two of the things that strike me very much about your films are, obviously, I think people know you for the high concept or the strong idea. There's always like a central strong idea that your films have in a way that a lot of other films don't seem to. And the other thing is that even your small characters, and I'm thinking of things like the construction worker in Q before he gets killed, they all have they all have characters and backstories and dialogue that indicates who they are and where they're from and everything like that. Were both those things sort of conscious things that you wanted to kind of put in your scripts, or is that just what came out once you started writing?
Well, I wanted all the people to have reality to them. They have an individuality. If you're going to have somebody in a scene, it doesn't take that much effort to give them some kind of human characteristics or conflicts. Usually I try to have everything have some kind of conflict to it. So if somebody was going to go and make a phone call, when they got there, somebody else would be in the phone booth taking up time and they couldn't get the phone. You know, instead of just having somebody get in the phone booth,
right.
I create some kind of obstacle. You know, so if somebody's a construction worker, then he's being picked on and bullied by other construction workers and he's furious, and then he gets eaten by the bird. So it's a little vignette, but it gives the actor something to play, and it gives the scene some body and some depth, and it's about something.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's one of the things that when I watch your films, it kind of feeds my enjoyment of it. Whereas, and I notice it not being there in other films. I notice other films just have disposable people. Even the secondary characters in modern movies can sometimes be completely disposable. So, and they also often lack the kind of high concept that you always come up with. I know.
Well, they have a lot of cliche characters. When a character appears, he may just be a cop, or whatever, or something, some other kind of occupation, doctor or whatever. But there's no effort to give them any meat on their bones, you know.
Yeah.
That's it. And usually the actors who play them have played the same part in dozens of movies and television shows. They, you know, there's the guy who plays always plays a cop. There's the guy who always plays a doctor, you know.
Yeah.
There's no variety to it. I don't like to have people who always play the same part. It's just tiresome. And it's boring for the actor, too.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. So you've produced, written, and directed, but are probably most recognized for your writing, would you say? Do you have a preference between the three?
Well, the writing's wonderful because you do it all by yourself. And there's nothing like it. You basically make the movie right there on the page. You got to have it on the page first before you can put it on the screen.
Definitely.
And then, of course, going to the set every day and directing the picture, I have a lot of fun because I do like actors, and I have a lot of fun kidding around with them and making them enjoy the experience and making them give a really good performance. And I'm right up there with them. I mean, I don't go and watch the scene on some video machine a block away from the set. I'm right there next to the camera where the actors can see me. And I'm there rooting for them and making them realize that I think they're just wonderful and they're giving a great performance. And sometimes I even give them money. I tip the actors when I like a scene.
Yeah.
I give them $100. I say, here's something for you for doing that scene so well. Don't tell your agent. And I give them $100. I always have a pocket full of $100 bills.
Yeah.
And I give them to the actors. They never got a tip from anybody in their lives before. It's a new experience for them. They can't believe it. And it always gets a laugh because they don't expect it and they've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I try to do anything to lighten the proceedings and make everybody have a good time.
It's probably why people kept coming back to work with you. And what is your, what I'm interested, because I'm not sure how much it was covered in the documentary because I'm trying to remember it all, but what is your process when actually writing a script? Are you always completely alone? Do you speak it out to yourself while you're typing it? Do you hear the voices in your head? Sort of what's the process for you when writing?
I nowadays I usually write longhand. Before this, I was dictating into tape recorders. Before that, I was typing. So I've done it every possible way. When I'm in New York City, it used to be if it was a beautiful day, and I would look out the window and I'd say, I don't want to stay in the house all day working. So I would take my tape recorder and go over to Central Park, walk around Central Park, and can you hold on just a second?
Of course, sir, yeah.
Sure, hold on. Hello, that's one of my cohorts. We're preparing a series of thrillers for J.J. Abrams' company, Bad Robot, and I've written 10 episodes, 10 one-hour thrillers that are all done and ready to be shot.
So, oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, and talking about high concept, because that's we're calling it high concept right now. But we'll see if they come up with a different name for the show.
That's fantastic. Can't wait to see that. And I was actually going to wrap it up by asking sort of what we can look forward to and also where the documentary is heading next and what you hope will happen from that.
The next screening of the documentary, to my knowledge, is in San Diego around the middle of February. And they've invited us down there, so we're going to go down for a couple of days.
Nice.
And of course, the 10 one-hour thrillers, if that gets on the air, it's probably going to go to Netflix or HBO or something. We would, be very excited about that because it's like getting 10 mini-movies, you know.
Yeah. So, and do you think you'll direct any, like Masters of Horror, or is it just a writing gig for you?
No, I think I might do one or two.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I might do one or two. But, you know, there's plenty of room for other directors to come in. I've talked to quite a few other directors who'd like to be involved.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it's, J.J. Abrams is a wonderful producer and a wonderful filmmaker in himself. And so, and he's a fan of mine. So It's nice to work with somebody that cares about your work.
Yeah, well, he just worked with Don Coscarelli, of course, with the Phantasm remastered.
Yeah, no, he's a wonderful guy, Coscarelli, a lovely person.
Well, it has been absolutely fantastic to speak to you, Larry. Thanks so much for giving of your time. And I just wish the documentary all the very best. I hope it gets a great release and cannot wait to see what happens with these J.J. Abrams 10 films. That sounds like something I would watch again and again.
Well, I think they're going to be really good. So, I mean, the scripts are great. I must say that. It's some of the best work I've ever done. So, and one after the other, you know, when you start to watch it every week, there's a brand new story, a brand new movie every week, a brand new thriller.
Yeah.
The cumulative effect should be amazing because there's so much good stuff, you know, one after the other. And I've written them all.
That's fantastic.
I'm very proud of that whole process. And thank you for the call. All right.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. Have a good day.
Bye-bye now. Sure.
So with all the interviews I've been doing lately, I have to say sometimes I just pinch myself. These are guys who I grew up watching and just phenomenal that I get to speak to them now. So that's pretty awesome. Now on to yet another fantastically awesome gentleman, the director Steve Mitchell, who made King Coen. And we talk further about Larry's career, but we also talk about the documentary, the nature of making such a film in Hollywood today, and the future of the film. So please sit back, don't touch that dial, and take a listen as I talk to director of King Coen, Steve Mitchell.
Let's get it going.
All right, excellent. So hello, Steve, and welcome to the After Movie Diner. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Nice to be here.
So recently you've directed King Coen, a documentary about the life and work of Larry Coen, who we had the pleasure of talking to earlier. The film is still doing the rounds in festivals and screenings the world over. Where did the idea come from for you?
Well, the idea, it's one of those things where I kind of backed into it. I was looking at Larry's IMDb page for some reason or another some years ago. And while I was very familiar with his feature credits and some of his TV credits, what landed for me was how many credits I didn't know of, how many credits he had that I was not aware of, primarily in television, primarily, I think, in the 80s and the 90s. But the sheer volume of what he did really made an impression on me, more so than I think I knew, because I knew all his Larco stuff and I knew a lot of his TV stuff. I knew the shows he created. But I've been producing DVD special features and commentaries, and I was thinking about a project that I could do. And this is sort of how it got started. I was working up at Image Entertainment, and, you know, I was talking to somebody up there, and I said, you know, this might not be a bad idea. So one of the people that I was working with, and they said, well, why don't you take it up to the front office? And I said, yeah, why not? Okay. And I walked into one of the guys in the front office, and I said, hey, you know, I have this idea, and sort of laid it out in the broadest of strokes. And they said, gee, sounds real interesting. Why don't you make it? Maybe we'll acquire it when you're done. Which is not what I really wanted to hear. I wanted to hear them say, gee, sounds like a good idea. What is it going to cost us? But that was sort of how it got started. And I started looking into the cost of it. I started looking into the idea of using clips. I started budgeting it, et cetera. And at that point, it looked like it was going to be way more expensive than I thought I could do. I was going to pay for it out of my own pocket, but it just seemed a bit more daunting just in terms of the numbers. So I kind of filed it away, but I didn't put it away. And then some years later, when crowdfunding came in, I said, you know, maybe this is the way to do it. And what I had to do was I had to find out whether Larry would be interested in, you know, having someone make a documentary about him in the first place. So I knew somebody who knew how to get his number. And I got his number and I called him up. And surprise, surprise, Larry picked up the phone. You know, I recognized his voice. And I said, I was who I was, interested in doing what I'm interested in doing. He said, come on up to the house. That's my Dad Larry Cohen impersonation. And I went up to the famous house, the house that I was aware of from a lot of the films.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a cup of coffee, and you know, I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, sure, if you can get a finance, I'll help you any way I can. And that was kind of how it all got started. And the crowdfunding was a tremendous flop. I was spectacularly bad at that. But ultimately, the idea would not go away. And I got to know Matt Berkowitz, my producer, socially, because he's one of the owners of La La Land Records, which is this great movie soundtrack label. And I was a customer, and I met him at Comic-Con. And somebody said, you know, he said to me, he says, are you the Steve Mitchell that co-wrote Chopping Mall? And I said, yes, I am. He says, oh, I'm a huge fan, and it's always nice to hear that. And we became friendly socially, and then eventually I had this idea. I said, I wonder if you might be interested. And we had lunch, and I said, well, this is what I was thinking about. I said, I want to do a documentary about Larry Cohen. And he goes, I'm already interested. And by the end of the lunch, he said the famous words, or I'm trying to make them famous. I don't know how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. And we did it.
Yeah. It was such a, when Larry was working sort of in the 70s and 80s, especially in his New York films, there's such a fascinating, I think everyone kind of knows Scorsese and everyone knows Woody Allen and things like that, but there was this rich sort of body of people making movies in New York. Larry was one, Bill Lustig, James Glickenhaus, Frank Henenlotter, people like that. And I came into Larry's work that way, I think, and I have always kind of loved it. And the film has a tremendous cast, and you managed to get a lot of people who have worked with Larry in it to share their memories. How was it assembling all the friends, filmmakers, and film stars for the film?
Well, you know, if I sort of look back at it now, I would say, gee, it was kind of a daunting task. But, you know, when you're making a movie like this, you know, it's like building a house, and you do it kind of a couple of bricks at a time. We knew a certain amount of people that we thought we could get relatively easily. You know, we were able to, you know, take advantage of some of Larry's connections. But it took a certain amount of time. It took a certain amount of time finding people. I mean, Moriarty was an important component for the movie. We knew that we had to have him. The problem was he had kind of gone, I'm not going to say in hiding. I mean, he's exiled himself to Canada. And in doing so, I think he sort of cut ties with any sort of agents or agencies or management. And, you know, if we don't have Moriarty in this thing, you know, it's because Moriarty was his leading man in Fox
right.
Pictures. And we're going, it wouldn't feel right. And, I remember reading Facebook, and Facebook does have its uses. Lee Pfeiffer, who was one of the editors of Cinema Retro, which is a great magazine, I think wrote an article about Moriarty because Moriarty is involved in politics, and he writes for a blog that I think came out of Canada. And I said, well, you know, let's shoot an email up to the blog and see what happens. And I was cutting with my editor, Kai Thomasian, and, you know, literally about 24 hours after I sent off the email, you know, the phone rang and I pick it up and I go, hi, it's Steve. And I hear, hello, Steve, Michael Moriarty, how are you? And I said, I'm looking all over for you. And he goes, well, you found me. And, you know, he was very charming and very delightful, and he's a big fan of Larry's. And, you know, he was willing to be interviewed. He wanted to sort of preview the questions to see if there was anything, you know. He was wondering if he could have even remembered anything. He wasn't entirely sure.
Yeah.
But we made it happen. We had to go to Canada to talk with him, but he was delightful and very game. And, you know, I'm a fan of his work, too, so it was a thrill for me as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan, and we were very lucky to connect with Moriarty over Facebook ourselves. And although he wouldn't do an audio interview, he did agree to do a written interview, and even allowed me to kind of send him extra questions once he'd sort of sent me back the original ones. And know, then he listened back to the show that we had about the stuff that we recorded, and he was doing a play-by-play on Facebook of my show, which was surreal. but no, he's certainly an interesting character and a fantastic sense of humor, I think. So, yeah, it was nice to talk to him, and it was great to see him in the film. We were talking to Larry about how the contradictions between him and Fred Williamson, particularly about the stunt work and things. Was that, how much of that do you think was sort of tongue in cheek from Fred, or do you think he really believes that?
Well, the simple answer is I'm not entirely sure, but I'll my guess is that Fred was pretty serious about that. You know, Fred is a confident man, and if Fred says something, I think that's what he believes.
Right.
You know, let's face it, both Fred and Larry are kind of forces of nature, and you know, they believe what they believe, and that it's interesting that sequence, which a lot of people think is really, really funny. That was one of the earliest things that we cut. We got Fred on board fairly early in the process. And when Kai and I were cutting, you know, that sort of he said kind of thing, just kind of, we sort of kind of got that right away. We got that without having to sort of try and find it or craft it. It became very apparent to us when we were casting that, you know, Larry remembered what he remembered and Fred remembered what he remembered. And, you know, so we just went with it. And what was nice about it was we did a little of that with Moriarty. And then when Larry did original Gangsters for Fred, there was another opportunity for us to do that kind of cutting and that kind of storytelling. So one of the things that you always want to remember, whether you're making fiction or nonfiction, is it's always nice to set something up early and then to pay it off later as well. So we got kind of lucky with that. And, you know, and the audience, of course, really enjoys that.
Yeah, it's a great sequence, and it's just fun hearing the stories at all, especially if you've grown up watching the movies. I think on the advent of Laserdisc, DVD, and now Blu-ray and all the behind-the-scenes stuff, which I know you've been involved in, that was sort of a taste. But now we're seeing these documentaries, whether it's, you know, Jim Wynorski, who I know you've worked with, had a documentary about him. Dick Miller recently mm-hmm. had a documentary about him. And now Larry, you know, these sort of cult icons, it's really great to be able to delve deeper into them. So was there anyone...
Oh, I agree. And I think it's important to get this stuff on the record.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
I think it's important to talk to these guys before, you know, before they're a footnote.
Yeah, completely. And I remember, I think it was, and I forget the name of the filmmaker now, but The Machete Maidens Unleashed, I think, was one of his first ones, and not quite Hollywood. He's done a couple of them, one about Ozploitation uh-huh. and one about the Philippine exploitation movies. And some of the people he gets in that as well are fantastic. So it's really nice now to be able to build a library of sort of feature-length docs about the actors, directors, and movies you grew up loving. So was there anyone you would have loved to have included in the documentary that you just couldn't get or couldn't reach or wouldn't agree to be in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You said something nice about the cast, and while I'm very happy with our cast, you know, whenever you make one of these things, you always go, gee, I wish I could have talked to so-and-so. Tony LoBianco, for example, was somebody that I reached out to, and maybe, you know, maybe I didn't reach out to enough. You know, I would have liked to have gotten him for, you know, to talk about God Told Me To.
Yeah.
Sharon Farrell was someone I wanted to talk to, and she had kind of agreed to talk with us, and then she changed her mind. you know, and I have to respect that. I was somewhat disappointed by it, but I have to respect that.
Of course.
You know, I think it would have been nice to have talked to Karen Black, who I think passed away. You know, I think not too long before we got started. You know, there's always somebody else. I mean, you know, the weird thing when you make one of these movies is, and, you know, I think at the end of the day, we had enough people in the movie, but you always start to think, do we really have enough people? Am I getting enough variety? Am I getting enough anecdotal stuff? Am I getting enough of a, am I getting all the colors that are part of the Larry Cohen universe? You know, there's no answer to that. I think one of the things that we kind of came around to was, well, every time we have to go do an interview, you know, we have to crew up and we have certain costs and everything like that. And then, you know, we might have had to do some more traveling or something like that. And after a certain point, you say, well, do I have enough to tell Larry's story? It's not about the cast. It's about Larry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you always want more and, you know, you always go, gee, if I'd maybe pushed that a little bit harder. But we got pretty lucky, especially with Yaphet Kotto, because Yaphet doesn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
Yaphet did this as a favor, you know, to Larry because he's so fond of Larry. So, you know, you go, well, we got Yaphet Kotto.
Yeah.
And if somebody else had made this documentary, maybe they wouldn't get Yaphet Kotto. So, you know, I'm pretty happy with the cast.
Yeah, it was a real delight to see Yaphet talk about Larry, because obviously Bone is certainly with hindsight now quite an important film, because like you say, he's a guy who doesn't really do interviews or hasn't been out in the public eye for a while. Along with sort of finding out, as I feel the audience does, but along with finding out the things you just didn't know that Larry Cohen had worked on or the stories behind them, what were some of the other favorite things that you discovered that you hadn't known previously about him or his work before researching Larry?
Wow, that's sort of a simple question, and I don't know if I have any sort of a simple answer for that, or even a complex answer. I think the thing that I learned about Larry that I wasn't aware of was how relentless he is. We got a taste of that when we started interviewing him. He starts. He doesn't want to stop.
Yeah.
He has a tremendous amount of energy, and I think the one thing that really impressed me was the fact that, you know, when you put Larry on a set, he never wants to stop. You know, one of the nicknames I've given him is, you know, he's the Energizer Bunny. You know, he just keeps going and going and going. And what was interesting, you know, Eric Bogosian was talking to us about, you know, shooting special effects, and they were shooting really, really long days. I mean, you know, they were shooting near Christmas, and I think they were shooting 16, 17 hour days. And this isn't young Larry. This isn't, you know, I mean, Larry was already a grown up basically when he made those movies. And yet he had the energy and the stamina and the drive of, you know, a kid in film school. That impressed me. I think the fact that, you know, Larry, and this is one of those things where, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing, I think, at the same time, is if he believes something, he will not let go, and he will be, you know, he will, if he disagrees with you, he can be very blunt.
Yeah.
He just believes what he believes in, and it goes to his focus, I think, you know, the fact that he wants to do everything, the fact that you know, he doesn't really, you know, want a crew, he doesn't really want to, you know, get lost in the trappings of Hollywood. I mean, you know, you go to a set, you know, a major set, even a TV set these days, you know, there's an army of people. They're all there to serve the directors and the stars. And, you know, while it is hard work, it can be comfortable on some levels. Larry doesn't give a shit about any of that stuff. I mean, he loves the actors, and he loves being with actors, and he loves being on set. And because he's a performer, you know, himself. I think the other thing, you know, getting back to the original question thing, I discovered that really surprised me is he had been a stand-up.
Yeah.
I had no idea that he had been a stand-up comedian in his youth and that, you know, he had the performer's DNA in him. That was a complete surprise. But I think the thing that just really impressed me is the fact that, you know, Larry, there's no real stopping him. He won't accept that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've had some disagreements and, you know, there are times I'm going, why is he taking out a hammer and, you know, and pummeling away at me with that? You know, it's just, he is a force of nature and he just, if he believes in something, and I think we have to say it in the film that he just, if he believes in something, he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why he's had the career that he's had. That and the fact that he's fertile, you know, as a writer, he's just so fertile. I mean, I'm a writer. I don't think I've had anywhere remotely close to having the fantasy of having as many ideas as he's had. And those are the ones that were produced. You know, I think he has over 100 writing credits for crying out loud. That's the produced stuff.
Yeah.
He's got plenty of unproduced stuff that he's talked to us about. It's amazing. He's the output of this man is amazing.
Were there any films or TV shows that you watched in research of the documentary that really surprised you that you would tell people who are now either listening to this for the first time or watching the documentary for the first time and go, that one, that's the undiscovered Coen gem? Are there any of those that you watched?
Well, you know, I think special effects and I'm having a senior moment here. I think I'm forgetting the other movie he made back to back with special effects.
Oh, Perfect Strangers.
Thank you for the save. You know, those were two movies I was not aware of even back in the day, and I think they're both interesting pictures. They're, you know, I kind of think of them as baby Hitchcock pictures.
Yeah.
And, you know, because the ideas are sort of Hitchcockian. And, of course, they were made on the ultra cheap. They were made almost like underground movies. And, you know, there are no members of the Screen Actors Guild, I think, are in those pictures. I think those are all New York actors who were sort of undiscovered, certainly at the time. They're really interesting movies, I think, and I like the filmmaking is interesting to me. I like Larry. You know, Larry's kind of in the gutter a little bit more with those pictures, and those are interesting. The other picture of his, which every time I see it or every time I think of it, it just becomes more and more of a favorite, which is The Ambulance.
I know, it's so good, right?
Yeah, it really is, and it's a crazy idea. I like the fact that Larry had a little money for this picture. You know, he had a little bit more money, a little bit more production in terms of, you know, Larry's movies are sort of caught, you know, they're kind of grabbed. This one feels like it's a bit more crafted. It's, you know, he had a little bit more time. And I just think it's a great story and it's very entertaining. I think Eric Roberts has a field day with the part.
Definitely, yeah.
And, you know, I recently saw that picture in Chicago with an audience. We were screening the movie at Cinepocalypse in Chicago and the audience was there, really was enjoying it. So, I mean, Cue the Winged Serpent is my favorite picture in Larry's, but The Ambulance is a very, very close second.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a huge fan of Q. I was able to see The Ambulance on the big screen last year in New York when they showed it at the Quad when they were doing a retrospective of his work, which was just fantastic and really eye-opening. And, you know, once the Blu-ray's out in March, that's my next Larry purchase. And it's funny you say about Perfect Stranger and special effects because, again, I think they were two that I wasn't necessarily aware of that will again, a sort of on my list now to either purchase or track down and watch because they, yeah, it's interesting to see that sort of period of of Larry's films that I just wasn't that dialed into as I was maybe his other stuff. When you were talking earlier as well that he was a stand-up, and Larry's humour comes through, it seems, in so many ways. When I was talking to him, he was saying that he was really the bad guy of his story. He was a terrorist and mean to his actors, and was surprised that he was remembered so positively and fondly. But so let me ask you, now that you've worked so closely with him, were you a bigger fan of Larry before, or are you a bigger fan of Larry now?
Well, it's interesting because at the time, I just knew the guy's work, you know, as a fan. And I'm going, every time I see his name on a movie, I knew I had to see it because not all of his movies completely work. They're certainly very rough around the edges, but, you know, as I've said before, that end title card, which is a Larry Cohen film, that title is earned.
Yeah.
And I always said that, you know, like the movies, don't like the movies, they're always interesting, you know, and you can't always say that about every filmmaker. That's number one. Number two is, you know, he's a triple hyphenate, so if it says it's a Larry Cohen movie, it's Larry. There's nobody's weighing in on anything. It's all him. So his filters are very strong. So I had a very strong fondness for him as a filmmaker, but then I got to know the guy, and, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes when you meet your heroes or people that you admire, they tend to be disappointing. Larry wasn't disappointing. Larry's a very interesting guy. I think, what I admired about him from a distance through the work, I still admire about him now that I know him personally, which is, you know, he is a very determined, creative artist. And, you know, he lives to create. It's his DNA is unlike anybody I know. I know a lot of creative people, and nobody is as driven as he is. Now, you know, he may just get bored and say, well, I'm just going to keep writing. You know, I mean, it might, you know, he, in a sense, maybe he's entertaining himself when he writes. And, you know, as a guy who's written, you know, sometimes you write a script and you finish it because you want to see how it turns out. And Larry has said something like that to me in the past. You know, he says, I want to see how it turns out. So he doesn't need to do it anymore. He could have stopped 20 years ago or 30 years ago and he would have had a hell of a resume. But it's who he is, and I'm very impressed by that, you know, because I know a lot of creative people, they get to a certain point, they're going, you know, I think I'm done. I think I'm tapped out. I think the reservoir is empty.
Yeah.
That's not the case with Larry, and, you know, I envy that in a lot of ways, actually. And I'm not only impressed by it, but I envy it. And I think that kind of creativity, I think, is sort of a pure thing. It's almost like radium, you know? And, you know, the energy in there is amazing. And, you know, Larry's entitled to slow down if he wanted to slow down, but that's not who he is. That's not what he wants to do. I mean, he is always continually and continuously creating material.
Yeah.
And now that I know him, I'm just so impressed by that.
So the film is currently touring festivals, and I think it's continuing into this year. What is next, and what is then the next step for King Cohen?
Well, you know, they call it show business for a reason. And right now we're in the process of selling it. We've made some deals. We're working on others. And the thing is that, you know, this is. Thank God this is not the stuff that I have to worry about. This is not, you know, I'm a producer in the movie. I'm interested in how this works, and I weigh in on it. You know, I have two partners who carry a lot of this water. And, you know, we're in the process of just, you know, getting the movie out there and getting a description, which, you know, is not an easy thing. I don't think anybody quite prepared me for that. You know, some people ask me, they say, you know, if you're going to talk to a young filmmaker, what advice would you give them? I would say, first off, become a plumber or an electrician.
Right.
It's easier. You'll probably make more money and you'll be more comfortable. But number two is, if you really have to do this, then get chummy with people who have money. because, you know, Larry was very fortunate. He was creating at a time where people would write him checks to make movies. You know, he had Sam Markoff. He had John Daly at Hemdale. You know, he had a number of guys and or companies that would write him checks so he could make his movies. So he didn't have to worry about that. And then the movies were being made for someone, so then they would take care of the distribution. Well, today, even though we have Warner Brothers and Paramount, Disney, and, you know, Lionsgate and everything like that, very few of those studios finance a picture. You have to find the money before you can even make the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes deals are in place for distribution, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it's not the way it used to be. And that's very hard. And, you know, it's what you have to worry about on the front end, and it's what you have to worry on the back end. You know, I know this is going to sound, it's going to sound silly maybe, but, you know, the movie was, by comparison, in a sense, relatively easy to make.
Yeah.
You know, I always believe that if we had enough pieces, my editor and I would figure out what the narrative was. And there was no narrative. I didn't know what the movie was going to be when we started it.
Yeah.
I had no idea where we were going to go. I mean, I knew if I had enough pieces, I'd be in good shape. I knew if we had enough personalities, we would be in good shape. And once, you know, I started to interview Larry, and of course I interviewed Larry first, and, you know, you've talked to Larry, you know, he's a great interviewer and there's no stopping him. I mean, the first day, I think we talked to him for 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah.
And I think the only reason he wanted to stop is I think his wife had come home and he wanted to have dinner with his wife. But so I had so much with Larry that I knew right out of the gate I was going to be able to make something interesting. But didn't know what it was going to be. And there were moments, you know, I said to my editor, I said, well, what are we doing? What direction are we paddling in? I felt we were adrift in the middle of the Pacific. You know, we didn't quite know which way to go. And I think everybody has that on any movie. But eventually I knew we would figure it out. In fact, that's kind of the mantra for the picture. We'll figure it out. But the money thing, the business part of it, that's a whole other animal. And you're dealing with different personalities. You know, you're dealing with people who look at your movie as if it's just product.
Yeah.
You know, and something that's going to go, you know, into a library or on top of a heap or something like that. You know, as a filmmaker, you want your movie to be treated well and with a certain degree of respect. And that's the business part of it. And it's not fun.
No, and it seems odd as well, just from an outsider's point of view, that while, you know, fans of film and historians of film are well aware of all that is out there and all that's been and come before, it seems odd right now that Hollywood, and you're even seeing this on streaming sites, cutting back and back on their back catalog stuff and just looking to produce new stuff. But it seems that Hollywood right now is very forgetful of its history and of its characters and of the people that have worked in it. They seem very focused on, you know, whatever. It's like they've narrowed everything down to the opening weekend. They've also narrowed everything down to just whatever's coming out in the next 3 months. They don't seem, you know, you see Shout Factory and Blue Underground and companies like that capitalizing on that because Hollywood is selling them their back-cat films to do special releases on. They've no idea the audiences that are out there for that, you know. So you may be coming up against that. I don't know, but I'm trying to distribute King Cohen.
We're dealing with a little of that. You know, the sad part is, and this is kind of a personal issue for me with Hollywood, is that Hollywood is not run by filmmakers. Hollywood is run by people who went to business school. Hollywood is run by people who only think of things in terms of what, you know, in terms of the money. And look, money is important. Money is relevant. Money is a big deal. I mean, no, there's no bucks, there's no picks.
Right.
And so I get that. I understand that. But the attitude towards films is, I think, unfortunately, not what it should be. I mean, it's really about dollars and volume, and you know, it's kind of the same way that it's happened with fiction. You know, when I grew up, I used to read a lot of what they call mid-level authors, and I would read mid-level type books. And, you know, I like B-movies too, you know.
Yeah.
And now the economics are such that everybody wants to be involved with the big hit, and they don't want to be bothered with anything else. And I think the problem is that anything else is where a lot of stuff lives. A lot of interesting product is in the mid-ground. But, you know, now every movie has to be an incredible blockbuster on Friday night.
Yeah.
And sadly, and this is the thing that I think as an audience member, just makes me sad, and I won't diatribe too much here, is that most movies are now being made for 16-year-olds.
Yeah.
Because 16-year-olds want to go out on a Friday night, go on a date, go out with their pals, and they want to go out of the house. Well, if you have a widescreen TV and you have, you know, a decent Blu-ray library, or you have Netflix, Amazon, all of the above, cable, why would you want to go out on a Friday night? I guess it's a rhetorical question, but why would you want to go out? You should make your popcorn the way you like it.
Right.
You don't have to listen to anybody. You have a big enough screen at home. I mean, I get together with my oldest friend most Friday nights, and we watch stuff on his, he's got a 70-inch screen, and, you know, we do what we used to do when we were young, which is we go to the movies. We just go to the movies at his house.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's changed a lot, and I don't know if it's changed for the better, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it has, you know, because the movies that seem to have lasted, the movies that have a 40, 50, 60-year-old lifespan are not the movies that are being made today. I don't see where and again, you know, yes, it's a business. So why are they not seeing the money in their back catalog that exists with, and not just necessarily with re-releases, but you know, with just with screenings and with new media and various other things? It seems very sad that new people coming to movies now might not have the experience or the ability. And I live in New York City, so a lot of the time New York City can get you down. You can think, oh, I don't have the money to live here. And one of the things that keeps me here year in, year out is the amount of retro screening houses there are here. Because if I go to the movies these days at all, it's 9 times out of 10 for either a B-movie that's happened to get a screening on a, you know, Cinema Village or something, or it's a retro screening that's out at IFC mm-hmm. or Anthology Archive. It's the one thing that keeps me in the city, because other cities don't really have that, unless you're in Hollywood, I guess, or somewhere like that.
Well, so, we have in Los Angeles. We have a number of places where we can do that.
Yeah, I
agree with you. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I've noticed on Facebook, certain people that have become Facebook friends are, you know, film fans / historians. And I, you know, it's interesting. The other day they were talking about the Seven Ups, which is the unofficial sequel to The French Connection.
Yeah.
And everybody was waxing rhapsodic, poetic about the movie. And, you know, at the time when the movie came out, it was sort of a sequel of The French Connection. It was a, it's, you know, not quite a B picture, but not quite an A picture. And now people discover movies like that, and they go, oh, geez, wow, why can't we have movies like this? You know, where they were what they were. They weren't trying to be more than what they are. And, you know, it was a genre picture. And the thing is, I don't know that the picture was a big success or not. My guess is it was probably maybe okay. But, boy, that movie is still valid today, you know, decades later. And, you know, it's interesting, a lot of the movies that are made today, and they're interesting movies that are made today. I mean, do you want to see any of them a second time? I know I don't.
No.
There's something off-putting about movies today in many instances that you don't want to go back and revisit them. And when I was growing up and when I was watching movies, if I discovered a movie I liked, I would go back and see it again and again and time after time. And it's just, that's the evolution of where we're at today. And, you know, bringing it all back to Larry, one of the things that's great about his movies is they're still with us. They're still here. They're still rewatchable. there's something about those movies that, that goes beyond the idea of seeing it on a Friday night and forgetting about it.
Yeah, definitely.
And I know as a filmmaker, you know, that's what I like. I want to celebrate. I want to celebrate the fact that these movies have value beyond, you know, what they were created for, in a sense. Like, even when Larry was making movies that were going out theatrically, you know, an opening weekend was a big deal. You know, having people lined up to go see a picture, you know, was a big deal. It was still about the money. But yeah, for some reason, the money and the movies seem to coexist a little bit better with one another. Maybe that's just 2020 hindsight. I don't know. But that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah. And I think that's why I always give props, and I know some people can complain about the reissues and they can complain about the cost, but I will always give props to people like Shout Factory, Blue Underground, Vinegar Syndrome, Twilight Time, whoever it is, because they're releasing films like The Ambulance, and they're releasing films like Special Effects, and they're, you know, allowing us to get a Larry Cohen commentary, or they're, you know, they're releasing these movies again that need to be seen and that can be discovered. And it's really, you know, the only way you can discover these movies nowadays is on these little retro releasing Blu-ray companies. And I mean, I hope that long continues, because streaming sites, unless you pick up a smaller streaming site like a Brown Sugar or a Shudder or something like that, none of the big three streaming sites are doing it anymore. So it's really just those Blu-ray companies that are keeping film fans discovering those movies, and I hope Larry's continue to get the releases they deserve.
Well, I do too, and I think that, you know, luckily the companies that you've talked about, if they're not run by fans, they are populated with fans.
Yeah,
on staff, and there is a dedication to trying to, you know, do nice, you know, versions or the best versions of these movies that we grew up with. You know, it's interesting. Larry always, you know, Larry was talking to me about AIP's lab, which was a lab called Movie Lab, which doesn't exist anymore. He would say that, you know, AI, you know, that Movie Lab was one of the lousiest labs in town because they never changed their chemical baths.
Yeah.
That it was kind of like making French fries with oil that just sat there for God knows how long. And, you know, it's interesting, growing up, when I was very, very young, I would go see an AIP picture maybe on the opening day, and the prints looked like shit. It, not so much the wear and tear, but just literally the prints weren't great.
Yeah.
And it always said Color by Movie Lab on it. Now you see these movies on, say, you know, MGM HD, and they went back to the original film elements, and they're doing new transfers. I didn't know that movie could look any good. You know, I didn't know those movies could possibly look good. I thought they always, you know, because they were cheap movies and they had cheap lab work, they were grindhouse movies. No, the movies were reasonably well photographed, and a good 35 negative yields a very strong picture. I mean, even look at a movie like Black Caesar, you know, which I think Olive put out.
Yeah.
You know, you look at that transfer and you go, who knew that movie looked that good? And I think that's the thing that's exciting about discovering a lot of these movies now on Blu-ray and some cable channels, is they're going back to the film elements and they're creating these transfers, and you really get to see what the cinematographers intended. And that's exciting for me as a fan. So, you know, hopefully for as long as I'm around, they continue to do this, because the surprise of seeing a movie that you knew but it always kind of looked like crap looking good, it's almost like seeing the movie new again, which is exciting.
Yeah.
And I admire the dedication all these guys have to trying to do this stuff. I mean, I know they're doing it to make money. I'm not naive. But the flip side is, just from a fan standpoint, it's a very good time to be a fan of old movies, because you're getting to see so many of them looking better than they've ever looked before.
Definitely. And it's fun sometimes, especially with like Amazon, you kind of get those recommendations and I'm like, oh wow, they released that. And I kind of dive in and find out the other ones that have been released. So it's always fun to kind of get new lists and new things that are coming out and experimenting with them. Just talking quickly then before we wrap up, you've been done Blu-ray and DVD behind the scenes stuff. When King Cohen is being put together for its Blu-ray. Is there a lot of stuff that can go on as extra features and things? Is that, do you have a lot of stuff left over, or are you just...
we've got so much extra footage that, you know, good stuff too. I don't want to like exactly promise, but I know we would have at least an hour of scenes we couldn't use. I mean, there's so many great stories that Larry told, but they were long stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're making a movie, you know, it's about pace and rhythm, and it's, the whole thing is, it's not about anecdotes. It's about the anecdotes to help create the portrait of him as a guy and as an artist and as a creator. So there were so many stories we couldn't use that we went, God, man, it's too bad we can't quite use that. But the thing is that when you're cutting a film, you're making a story, you know, at a feature length, and you're creating a portrait of who Larry is. Whereas when you do DVD special features, you know, you say, okay, this, you know, we'll do 10 minutes on, and, you know, and do anecdotes about this. We'll do 10 minutes on that. It becomes about the anecdotes.
Yeah.
I had so much to work with just from Larry alone, but I had so much to work with from Larry and other people that we'll be able to put together quite a deleted scenes or extra scenes component for the Blu-ray, because there's so much good stuff. You know, Larry is always giving me a hard time. Why don't you talk about this? Why don't you talk about that? And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm creating a portrait of him. I'm not just going down his credits list.
Right.
You know, he always says, well, you should have done a miniseries. And I frankly, you know, if someone would have allowed me, I guess perhaps I could have done a multi-part documentary about him, because he has so many credits.
Yeah.
But, you know, the movie is what the movie is, and it's a portrait of who he is. And then so on the Blu-ray, the benefit of having the Blu-ray is that, you know, there'll be a lot of these extra anecdotes, which I think people will enjoy. So, there'll be quite a bit. There'll be a lot of stuff on there. What, I don't know yet, but there'll be quite a bit.
And last question then, has this encouraged you or put you off doing a documentary on other people in the future? And is there anybody else that you would like to, or anything else that you would like to do a feature documentary on?
I've got about a half a dozen ideas, at least. And, you know, this is, it's interesting. I kind of backed into this work some years ago, and I think I had some feeling for it, and I enjoy doing it. And the trick now is to try and get the next one off the ground. I don't know which one that would be, but I have, you know, like I said, I have a handful of ideas, different ideas. But, you know, if I just become a biographer, you know, a cinema biographer of people who worked in the film business, I have a problem with that, because, you know, at the end of the day, I'm the audience.
Yeah.
I want to know this stuff. I'm interested in this stuff. So I remember, well, I was working on the old Combat TV series DVDs, and I was a big fan of that show because I watched that show with my dad. And the thrill for me when we did that was I got to hear all this stuff first. So it's great to do these types of projects because you get to hear all the good stuff first.
Yeah.
You're the first kid on the block. So, yeah, if I can continue to do this, I will continue to do this. I enjoyed making this movie a great deal. It was a great experience for me. It was a great experience getting to know Larry, and it was a great experience working with my partners. And, you know, for anybody who's listening to this, you know, my feeling is get really good partners who have your back, and it makes the process so much easier, you know. It's no movie exists in a vacuum. If you have a lot of support, it's amazing what you can get done. And, you know, I think about what we did with this and I go, what were we thinking? I don't know, what a crazy idea this was. And yet you just don't acknowledge that until maybe after the fact. And that, we got lucky. I think we were very lucky. I think luck, you know, Sidney Lumet's one of my favorite directors, and, you know, he always talks about how luck plays a big part in any success. And I think we were lucky. And I think we were lucky with Larry, because Larry turned out to be way more fascinating than I would have ever imagined.
Well, Steve, I can't thank you enough as a fan of Larry's and as a fan of documentaries about movies. I can't thank you enough for and your crew for putting all the time and energy into making this, because I saw it at the New York screening last year in Chelsea and absolutely loved it. Can't wait. Whatever its future may be, I'll purchase a copy of the Blu-ray for definite, but if it's on streaming or if it ends up in the theaters, I'll let people know about it. Thanks so much for the film, and thanks so much for coming on our show today to talk about it and Larry and everything else.
No, it was my pleasure. It was a lot of fun, John.
Well, thank you for listening to this special Larry Cohen edition of Booth Talk from the After Movie Diner. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on the Booth Talk stream. And if you like these interviews, check out other interviews over at aftermoviediner.com. ¶¶